Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
No more tired or poor, no more huddled masses yearning to breathe free, definitely no more wretched refuse. With apologies to Emma Lazarus, from now on you'll need a tip-top resume and bankable skills to come to this country, because Congress made a deal on immigration today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be with us today. It's Thursday, May 17th. It's a bill that's got a little something for everyone. Republicans get border security and a national employee verification system. Democrats get a path to citizenship for some of the immigrants who are in this country illegally. The deal's a long way from done, but you might even call it bipartisan. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale starts us off today.
The hurdles for citizenship are higher in this proposal than in the bill that passed the Senate last year. That means the new version is attracting more support from Southern Republican senators, including Arizona's John Kyle, who voted no last year. At today's announcement, Kyle said illegal immigrants with clean records will be eligible for a temporary but renewable 4-year residency pass. After 8 years residency, they can apply for a green card.
Like any other applicant for green card, you have to wait in line. You can't cut in line. Secondly, you'd have to apply not here in the United States, but from your country to get that green card. You have to pass an English test. You have to have paid your fines. There are other fees that would have to be paid.
5 years later, a green card holder can apply for citizenship. Eligibility would be enhanced by a complicated point system that favors immigrants with job skills, knowledge of English, plus community and family ties to the U.S. President George Bush said he could sign the Senate proposal.
This is a bill where people who live here in our country will be treated without amnesty, but without animosity.
To achieve this compromise, a group of 15 to 20 senators from both parties spent weeks plowing through detailed plans for beefing up border security and a verification system for employers. Members of the negotiating team credit Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy with a dogged pursuit of solutions. Today, Kennedy said this is his best shot.
Politics is the art of the possible, and the agreement we just reached is the best possible chance we will have in years to secure our borders, bring millions of people out of the shadows and into the sunshine of America.
Advocates on both sides of the immigration issue said late today they're waiting to see more details of the compromise. The Senate expects to vote on the bill by the end of next week, and leaders in the House hope to approve similar legislation next month. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We were reminded again today that the current chairman of the Federal Reserve sees things differently than his still-in-the-news predecessor. Ben Bernanke told The World this morning the housing slowdown probably does have further to run, but he doesn't think it'll derail the whole economy. What's-his-name Greenspan made a speech of his own today in Atlanta. He's been saying there's a 1-in-3 chance of a recession this year. We asked Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to find out whether the incumbent might be getting a little irked with all the ink the other guy's getting.
Bernanke must feel like the guy who batted after Babe Ruth. You remember him, don't you? Okay, it's not that bad. But Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says Greenspan's public musings aren't that good either. Weiss has worked at the Fed.
I think it has to annoy Bernanke. I think it certainly takes a lot of focus off of Bernanke, and it rather fuzzes the message.
Other economists agree that it's bad to create uncertainty about the Fed's message. But Commerce Bank chief economist Joel Naroff says that's not happening because there's no doubt who's running the Fed.
Mr. Bernanke, everybody knows that. And regardless of what Mr. Greenspan says, Mr. Bernanke is the Fed chairman, and he's the one to either show that he knows what he's doing or doesn't know what he's doing.
But Standard & Poor's David Weiss worries that Greenspan may be creating uncertainty anyway.
Remember, a lot of people also understand that even though Bernanke is now in charge, he's in charge only with the assistance of a majority vote of the people at the Federal Open Market Committee. And I think people treat comments from Greenspan much as they would similar comments from another member of the Federal Reserve Board.
He says the result can be misleading.
It comes across that maybe there's disagreement within the Fed since Greenspan has been just so recently there.
An ocean away yesterday, someone asked the Bank of England's head whether central bankers like Greenspan should comment on policy matters once they leave. He replied that he's grateful his predecessor has stayed out of the public eye. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
There were more deals done today on Wall Street, but investors weren't really buying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Paul Wolfowitz will leave the World Bank as of June 30th. The statement from the board of directors late this afternoon says mistakes were made on both sides and that Wolfowitz acted in good faith. The search for a successor will begin immediately. Before the announcement, I spoke with Krishna Guha at the Financial Times, and I asked him what the recent intrigue will mean for the bank's future, no matter who's in charge.
Well, I think it says a couple of things. First of all, that it really is necessary for the bank to have a leader who commands the respect of his staff, the support of his executives, and the support of the shareholder governments who sit on the bank's board and ultimately provide all its funds. That obviously means the US government, but it doesn't mean just the US government. It means, of course, the big European players who contribute a lot of money, but really all the major governments in the world.
Do you think it will have an effect on contributions to the World Bank from those governments?
Absolutely it will. If this all ends in the least bad way it could from now, we might yet see a successful IDA fundraising round. This is the bank pool of money that it uses to make very concessional loans to poor countries in Africa. But were this to end unhappily, either side, either the Europeans or the U.S. administration, might feel unwilling to pony up the cash.
Mr. Wolfowitz came to the bank with an agenda that included cleansing a lot of its recipient countries with corruption and scandal. The irony is cheap here, but what does this episode say about the bank's ability to continue with those agendas?
Well, it clearly shows that if you're going to preach a message of good governance, and here I think it's really more a question of governance rather than actual corruption. No one is suggesting Mr. Wolfowitz is personally corrupt. So what this story tells us is that if you're going to preach this message, you'd better make sure that as the bank, you have your own house in order. But I think it also teaches that this is not an easy subject to address. It's a very important subject. But when Mr. Wolfowitz first addressed the corruption questions in the developing world, he made it all sound a little bit easy, a little bit black and white. I think he in time came to understand himself that while corruption is a huge obstacle to development, it's not possible just to say, well, we'll walk away from a poor country if it has corruption in it.
The bank was set up at a very different point in history when the economic situation globally was very different. Is this a time perhaps people will start questioning whether we need a World Bank, whether private capital can't do what it does and better?
I think certainly people are asking those questions, and I think the next head of the World Bank will have to provide some much better answers about what the bank is for in the long run. But I think that it's still too soon to say that the bank can just be replaced by private foundations and private capital markets. Look, there are a lot of very, very poor countries that still are not creditworthy for private markets.
This choice was controversial from the beginning. To what extent do you think the controversy was deepened by Mr. Wolfowitz's desire to shape economic development policies to fit U.S. government foreign policy aims?
There's certainly a very wide and deep perception both among the staff and among board members that was the case. Mr. Wolfowitz always claimed that it was not so. But there are certainly enough cases where it looked as if you could see evidence of this. For instance, he suspended some big loans to India on the grounds of corruption, but not to Pakistan, a country next door with very similar corruption problems at a time when, of course, Pakistan was crucial in the war on terror in Afghanistan. I think what this shows is that you really need to have a president who's seen as not being in the pocket of the U.S. administration, because even if such a person then acts in a way that is fair and reasonable, they'll always be suspected.
Krishna Guha covers the World Bank for the Financial Times out of Washington, D.C. Mr. Guha, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Congress made a deal on a 2008 budget plan this week, or maybe it's more accurate to say Democrats in Congress did, because a key part of the package is letting President Bush's tax cuts expire. That's much to the consternation of conservatives, who say the economic growth over the past 5 years or so is because of those tax cuts. Commentator Stephen Moore points out that's an idea Ronald Reagan made popular 25 long years ago.
Reaganomics is now officially dead in Washington. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charlie Rangel killed it. He's writing a tax bill that would raise federal tax rates to their highest level in 30 years. The top income tax rate could go from 35 to 45% next year. The capital gains tax rate would double under this plan. Presidential candidates Barack Obama and John Edwards both openly boast of their willingness to raise tax rates on the richest 1%. Why? Because the rich can afford it, they say. But are these politicians paying any attention to tax collections? The Treasury Department just announced that April tax receipts were higher than in any other month in history, up 11% from the same time last year. The richest 1% of Americans now pay 35% of all income taxes, the largest share in our nation's history. More than half of the tax filers in the highest tax bracket are small business owners, according to the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation. Does anyone really believe raising their taxes will create more jobs? It reminds me of the adage, liberals love jobs, but they hate employers. Here's what's worrisome. Overnight, the U.S. could go from one of the lowest tax nations in the world to one of the highest. The House tax plan could outdo even socialist France, which after their recent elections is looking to cut taxes, attract investment, and grow the economy. The idea that lower tax rates spur growth and raise living standards is the modern economic operating system around the world today. Fast-growing China, India, and Ireland have all chopped taxes to lure foreign investment. Russia has a 13% flat tax today. So regrettably, Reaganomics may be dead in America, but the spirit of the Gipper is very much alive on most of the rest of the globe.
Stephen Moore is a member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal. Let us know what you think if you get a minute. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Coming up, pulling the land out from under trailer parks and from the people who live there.
I don't easily get defeated, but I don't know where to go at this point.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors didn't stray far from the center line on Wall Street today as they pondered mixed economic news. The Dow Industrials finished 10 points lower. That's just shy of 0.1%, coming to rest at 13,476. The Nasdaq shaved off a little more, 0.33%, or 8 points, to close at 2,539. The S&P 500 gauge was down a single notch, just 1 point, which amounted to less than 0.1%. It ended the day at 1,512. Nervous investors dug a hole for Caterpillar after one analyst downgraded the stock, warning that weakening U.S. demand is likely to end its recent run-up. Shares of the Earth Moving Equipment Company have climbed 21% this year, but today they went sliding almost 1.5%. A sharp rebound in the price of oil helped boost energy stocks today. ConocoPhillips shares spurted up 2.5%. Chevron stock rose almost 1%. ExxonMobil shares gained almost 0.5%. Bond prices sank. That pushed the yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note up to 4.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with 4 top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Waitress, a comedy about a diner waitress who finds inspiration in motherhood, friendship, and pies. In select theaters now. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. The Cato Institute discusses the alternative minimum tax. The American Civil Liberties Union participates in Privacy Day during Washington Whistleblower Week. Panels will discuss workplace privacy, among other topics. And you may see more cyclists on the road tomorrow, or perhaps you'll be one of them. It's National Bike to Work Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center in New York City can seat 2,700 people, 2,738 to be precise. But when we wanted to talk to a television writer about the big network ad pitches happening there this week, we had to track him down in Chicago, where he was watching what are called the upfronts on closed circuit. That's because Avery Fisher Hall was jammed to the rafters with ad buyers. Aaron Barnhart is the TV critic at the Kansas City Star. Hey, Aaron, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, likewise, Kai.
Let's get to the bottom line first, I suppose, as it were, and talk about how much money the networks are thinking to get. Last year, it was just shy of $9 billion in the upfronts. Are they going to get close to that this year, top it? What are they going to do?
They might very well get the $9 billion that they have traditionally gotten in recent years. I think it peaked at around $9.5 billion a couple of years ago. But the other question is, when are they going to get the money? See, these upfronts used to be sort of the feeding frenzy kind of at SeaWorld when they throw chum in the pool. You know, as soon as these presentations, these big song and dance affairs in New York got done, they got down to brass tacks and everybody, you know, was trying to sign deals as quickly as possible. Now what you're seeing is that the upfronts are dragging on and on throughout the summer. Last year, the upfront was a very protracted process, and all indications are it's going to be another long summer again.
All right. Well, even though you can't be there, Aaron, these are, by all accounts, sort of a tough upfront for the networks. What are they dealing with this year that's sort of different than in the past?
There's so much now more in play. There are more variables out there. We have talked about DVR usage in the past, the people using time-shifting machines to skip past commercials. There's also been in the past year two new ratings that have come out from Nielsen, the ratings company. One of the metrics is called Live Plus. I'll just give you one number here, 32%.
Mm-hmm.
This is the percentage by which the audience for one show, NBC's The Office, jumps between the time that the show airs and 3 days later when all of the time shifters have been able to watch the show. So the networks want credit for all that extra viewing that goes on. The advertisers respond by pointing to another metric that Nielsen has come up with called commercial ratings. The half-hour or hour-long program rating for a show minus all that pesky program content that gets in the way of the commercial.
That's right.
And the advertisers are saying, look, you know, it's great that people have these DVRs and that broadcast shows are the most popular things recorded on DVRs, but we want to use these commercial ratings as a proof of performance that the people who are watching your shows are also sticking around for the commercials. And that's going to make negotiations awfully hairy this summer.
Aaron, let me move away from the technology and from Madison Avenue and the advertising and talk about the actual programming here for a second. You know, some big hits like Lost and 24 are seeing declining audiences. Survivor had its lowest ratings in forever. How are they changing the programming?
Well, you nailed it, Kai. The trend for serial dramas is DOA. There are not going to be any new serial thrillers or dramas this fall and probably for a long time. The other big change that you're going to see is in scheduling. We are starting to see, finally, the end of the hiatus, this long vacation that many popular programs take because the networks are trying to stretch a 22-episode order over a 39-week broadcast season. And so now you're seeing programs like Law and Order, for instance, are going to come back at midseason. These are programs now where the networks have figured out if we put it on and just keep it on and don't show reruns and don't take it off the air, that's the way to hold on to the audience.
Aaron Barnhart is a television critic for the Kansas City Star. He runs a website called TVBarn.com. We got to him in Chicago because there wasn't enough room for him in the upfronts at New York. Aaron, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
A politician is kind of like a product, marketed in different ways depending on the crowd. You know, when they talk to unions, they're pro-labor. When they talk to wealthy donors, they love tax cuts. Marketing to younger voters, though, presents a different challenge. And candidates are using the internet to reach that demographic, including some social networking sites like MySpace. So how are they doing? We sent Youth Radio's Alana Germany to check it out.
MySpace is my life. I'm on almost 24/7, but I still don't understand why presidential candidates would want to be on MySpace.
It's an inexpensive way to reach an audience that sometimes gets ignored, younger people.
That's Joe Tooman, a professor of speech and communications at San Francisco State University.
It's a great place to recruit people to work in your campaign, and it's an interesting place to think about how you can do fundraising.
20-year-old Quincy Mosby is one of the thousands of MySpace users whom candidates have reached. He friend-requested Barack Obama in hopes of linking to the senator's profile and rallying support for his candidate.
I like to think that, you know, by having him up there, that'll make them think about, hey, maybe I should vote for that guy, because he's on Quincy's page, and Quincy seems to be not such a bad dude.
And take it from an expert. In a place like MySpace, that's like a big popularity contest, a lot is riding on how you present yourself.
Well, I'm Hillary Clinton, and I'm running for president.
The upside of Hillary Clinton's site is there's a lot to look at. The downside is all the merchandise she displays, which is kind of tacky. It's also interesting that there's no sign of Bill around. John McCain's MySpace layout is ridiculously boring. A dark background with hazy white stars. As you scroll down his page, the stars disappear and you descend into blackness. I hope that's not what his presidency will be like if he's elected. Mitt Romney goes wrong in his picture section. They're all of him at rallies, shaking hands here, giving hugs there. Please, the baby kissing bit is the oldest trick in the book. John Edwards' page is my favorite. MySpace is all about being yourself. And in his pictures, he's playing with his children on the beach and having lunch with volunteers during a cleanup after Hurricane Katrina. So what are the presidential campaigns ultimately hoping to get out of their social networking profiles? Professor Joe Tooman says, in the end, no matter what the platform, candidates are still commodities.
They're packaged like products, and the prettier and more appealing you can make something, the more likely you are to sell it.
I'm Alana Germany for Marketplace.
Alana's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. Consider just for a second the mobile home park. Depending on who you talk to, they're either icons or eyesores. But either way, these double-wide slices of the American dream might soon be nothing more than historical footnotes. Rising land values are putting the squeeze on trailer parks. In Washington state, so many have closed, it's turned into a full-blown housing crisis. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Follow Seattle's old Highway 99 out of the city, and a patch of green eventually breaks up the rows of car dealerships, Home Depots, and fast food chains. The small wooded trailer park is where 63-year-old Karen Mason, a double amputee, planned on spending the rest of her life.
I'm happy here. It's light, bright. I get around easily. I take care of me and two cats that have been in my life for a long time.
5 years ago, Mason paid $80,000 for her home. Now her only remaining asset has become a liability. She owns the home but not the land, and the owner of that land has decided to turn it into a BMW dealership. Mason and the other tenants of Evergreen Estates now have to pay to remove their mobile homes. Mobile is a bit of a misnomer. It can cost up to $16,000 to move these units. They don't have wheels and are hooked up to utilities like any other house. Half the time, the only place to move them is to the dump.
Who can afford that in their heart, to stand back and watch the home you invested in being handed a bill for it?
Usually the state's relocation fund would have picked up the bill, but the pace of park closures in Washington has snowballed in recent years, quickly draining the fund. That leaves Karen Mason and the residents of 20 other mobile home parks scheduled to close this year, pretty much on their own.
I don't easily get defeated, but I don't know where to go at this point.
For the poorest, there aren't many options. Few of the remaining mobile home parks have free space, and there's a 1 to 3 year wait for subsidized housing.
We are definitely in crisis mode in Washington State.
Seattle attorney Ishbel Dickens is working with the evicted residents. She says mobile homes, which she prefers to call manufactured homes, are an essential piece of the nation's affordable housing. But that affordability comes at a price.
People who live in manufactured housing communities own the home, but they rent the lot. And so it's pretty vulnerable to land values increasing and the land underneath their homes literally being stripped away from them.
Dickens says preserving these communities should be a priority. Several bills in the state legislature aimed at doing just that failed to pass. And for good reason, says Ken Spencer, who heads the landowners' trade group, the Manufactured Housing Communities of Washington.
The highest and best use of the land is not as a manufactured housing community anymore. And so there's tremendous pressure. It's worth more as another use.
Spencer says it's wrong to prevent the owners from taking advantage of their land's rising value. Don't tell that to the residents of Wonderland Estates south of Seattle. They're part of a growing grassroots movement aimed at saving their parks, one pancake breakfast and fundraiser at a time.
Okay, folks, listen up for your drive. Listen up. The first number is 356. All right.
72-year-old Iola Puckett raffles off donated bread makers and barbecue sets to the breakfast crowd. The goal is to purchase the park, possibly through a joint venture with a county or a nonprofit. They've even asked Bill Gates.
We put in a request, but we haven't received any answer back.
She says they've raised $11,000 so far. That's a long way from the landowner's $14 million asking price.
If you look in the bottom of the barrel, there's a bunch of change. For some people, that's all they had to give. Yeah, it makes it pretty cool.
Puckett says before this crisis, none of the residents of Wonderland Estates knew each other. Now, they're all in it together. In Seattle, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Sam took some pictures of the people and the parks he visited while he was out reporting that story for us. They're on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today. A couple of weeks ago, the government of Estonia took down a World War II memorial in its capital of Tallinn. The Russian government let it be known it was none too pleased by that. Today, Estonia's defense minister said his country is under an electronic embargo of sorts being orchestrated from Moscow. Estonian government and business internet sites have been shut down by hacker attacks. The defense minister says those attacks are coming from computers inside Russia, some with Russian government addresses, a million computers in all over the past 2 weeks. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 10 points, just shy of a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq down 8 points, a third of a percent. The S&P 500 dropped a point, not quite a tenth of 1% there. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time, selling Bhutan to the outside world.
Everyone comes here with a big dream, and I've come here with a big dream that somewhere we would strike it lucky, where we would reach out to the people and let us know what we are about.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.